Session number 10133.
Dwadley, reel 3.
Right. Yeah, as a result of Bill the Frenchman, Wilhelm Wolfgang was his name, and as a result of him talking to Franz Jungbert over the months, that Franz Jungbert came up to us and said that he would like to join the Free Czech movement, and we sent out all of his particulars, and one day, amongst the supplies that were dropped in, was a cap badge and a bit of bump written in Czechoslovakian, welcoming him into the Free Czech movement, fighting with the gallant allies in the mountains and all this sort of thing. And he retained his German rank, which was corporal, I think. And he proudly wore this Czech cap badge, and he had them on his shoulders, Czechoslovakia and things. And then when we moved down to Gallic City in 44, this was very, very cheeky on our part. We took over part of a disused monastery a mile outside Gallic City, overlooking the town itself. And there was a beautiful villa built on the headland, and we thought, no one will look for us here. We're right on their doorstep. They're going to start looking up in the mountains. So we moved down there for the summer, or the spring. And I had my setup, my radio in the monastery, and Jeff and those passing through, the Italian, American pilots that had been shot down and we were sending through on the escape route and things like that, lived over in the villa. And I used to trudge across there, I suppose about a mile, with my messages, collecting and delivering, and virtually two separate entities. And on my side, there was myself, Bill the Frenchman. We had our own cook, a couple of hangers-on and bodyguards, and Franz Jungbert. And one evening, he disappeared. It wasn't all that peculiar, in as much as if you wanted a beer or you wanted to talk to one of the local lasses, I mean, this had been happening on occasions, and nip down yourself, as long as you let people know that you had gone there and would be back. But France had disappeared, and this was in the evening. And then first thing I knew, at dawn, half the German army turned up on the main road just at the base of the hill, and they opened up with everything. And Franz Jungbert had gone back to Etir, which was just across the bay. He'd gone round the bay a matter of 5 or 6 miles, and with no hesitation they'd come roaring back and try to take us, and that was a bit sticky.
So he betrayed you?
Oh yes, very much so.
When was this?
February of 44, I think, that occurrence, wasn't it? Something like that.
So it's 6th of February 1944.
Yeah.
The HQ was attacked by a strong force of 300 Germans.
That's it, someone. And we had to get out of that very quickly, and we loaded up and got out. Jeff and his lot got their bits and pieces. I was the one that was holding things up, because I had all the bulky stuff to get out and get up quickly. So we loaded it up and let fly a couple of times, and loaded something else and let fly a couple of times, and then there came a couple of near misses which made us load even faster, and we got out. But that was Franz Jungbert, the Czech, from Dux Dayton. I always remember that.
You mentioned those people joining the security battalions. What was the general attitude of people in your area towards the security battalion?
Oh, the people in Greece didn't like them. You see, they being Greeks, knew the Greek, and they would ferret out bits of information. I mean, they'd go to an area where they weren't known, and they'd start asking questions, going to the local taverna and things. They were very hard. Their justice was just as bad as the Germans, and the Germans on occasions were brutal. I mean, if you did anything on the reason we stopped using the rifles. It was the fact that you blew up a van, a lorry, or shot a couple of Germans, the nearest village. Oh, it suffered, the nearest village. I mean, 10, 20 to 1 men. And if the Greeks knew we were going down near the road, they'd clear the village before we got started. And
so they take reprisals of 10 or 22 for everyone they lost.
The reprisals on occasions were bad, very bad, very bad indeed. And if any information was needed, the Germans would go in, yes. But they would go in physically to arrest and carry out whatever was needed. But the Rallis troops, the security police, they would go in civvy clothes. They would go in uniform, but they'd go in civvy clothes and they'd ferret out people and bring them in. They would parade and patrol the big towns, but in the villages, you couldn't tell whether that newcomer coming around the corner was someone making his way from a village 100 mile away and was going to a village 100 mile farther on, or whether he was a local Rallis man from around the corner who was just coming asking a few questions.
So did German reprisals eventually put a stop to your activity?
No. No, on occasions it had to be done, and it was restricted to a worthwhile target that was either at the instigation of Cairo or one that we thought was of sufficient importance that we would notify Cairo that we were going to have a go at it. And most of these hit and run do's, was during animals and the little jobs that we did, each with its own code name, for particular little jobs, or just pure devilment to keep the Germans occupied. And you'd do whatever you had to do, wherever it had to be done. You would let the locals know, or you would do your damnedest not to carry out any job anywhere near any habitation. I mean, if you had villages, say 10 miles apart, whatever you were going to do had to be done on the road, you would do 5 miles from either, you know, sort of midway. I mean, if you can imagine a main road up in those hills, up in those mountains, a series of zigzags, well, you can see from the map some of them. I mean, you could stand here and see the road over there, you know, sort of 2 miles away, but you've got to travel 3 miles to get that 2 miles. And if you wanted to plant something on the road to hold everybody up, you'd make sure that it was done way, way, way over there, because up there was X and down there was Y. If it was down on the plains, you would give them the benefit of the doubt, and you wouldn't do it, because there were the more villages down on the plains, you see. But up in the mountain, that road going up through the mountains, there were occasions where you had quite an area of road you could play around with. The railway line, once again, if you went down to the railway line, you didn't really think of the consequences. You had to do the rail or the bridge or the gully or whatever it may be, so you did it.
Was there any other optimism about the German withdrawal from Greece? Did you think that the Germans were withdrawing quicker than they actually did?
No. They packed the country immediately prior to Sicily. I believe Churchill or somebody said that as a result of the ferment we caused within Greece, that they brought in a couple of wings of aircraft and 5 or 6 divisions that could all be afforded elsewhere, because they were convinced that's where it was coming from. And we tied them down. And even though Sicily was invaded and even Greece afterwards, the number of Germans didn't drop. If anything, it increased, because the Italians suddenly packed up. And they had to take over the jobs that the Italians had been doing. Not that they'd been doing very much, and certainly not doing it very well, but they were there in numbers. And
Were there large Italian forces in your particular area, round about Amphissa?
They had a lot of Italians at Amphissa. They had battalion strength, always had battalion strength or better in Litharici. They had headquarters of the area in Atia. And all of these suddenly packed up. And that's when the Germans had to go in and do it. They had to have their little strong points, little garrisons in all these places that had originally been Italian. So, yes, there were Germans there in strength. And then it became apparent, even to them, that they would have to eventually get out because as the British troops in Italy got farther and farther north and they saw they were being pushed out, they knew that eventually they'd have to go because otherwise they're going to be cut up. I mean, if they went to the top of Italy and turned right and cut straight across the Balkans, they're going to be in a fine pickle.
What did the local Greeks in your area think of the Italian forces?
Well, if they had to attack anyone, they'd sooner do them, because they treated them in the most derogatory manner. I mean, they were always referring to them as macaronis and spaghettis, and they'd sooner go down and mix it with the Italians when they did go down than with the Germans. I mean, the German was a soldier, a damn good soldier. The Italians weren't. Especially the Italians from the south. The Italians from the south conscripted and put in uniform. And we have them on many occasion, odd individuals struggling up into the hills and coming up and crying their eyes out and telling us that they were frightened and they wanted to become prisoners of war. They were little men that were dressed in a uniform, which they didn't want to wear, caught up in a war which they didn't want to fight. And even the northern Italians themselves despise the southern Italian. And they certainly weren't soldiers. Mind you, when they're winning, different thing. I mean, they would knock you around, as had been experienced by the boys up in the desert. I mean, when they were taken prisoner, the southern Italian would knock them around as well as anybody. But as soon as the trouble started, the ones that packed up in there, tens of thousands were invariably the southern Italians standing at the side of the road with a little case ready to give up.
Did the Italian troops before the autumn of 1943 take reprisals against Greek villages?
No, I've not heard of any. I've not heard of any at all. But then I've not heard of them doing very much. And the ones I saw were either those that were down in the towns and were lounging around leaning against street corners off duty, or those that deserted and made their way up the hills. I mean, on the odd occasions that we went down to the town, we had to go down to the towns and we might slip our jacket off and put a shepherd's jacket on just to go down there to whatever we had to do. I mean, I had to go to the dentist, so I went down there and had my tooth done. And there were sloppy looking efforts hanging around there. I mean, literally, you could see them standing there. They might have the rifle on their shoulder, but they're just as likely to have one hand round the barrel and the butt sort of on the floor at an angle of 45 degrees, left hand in his pocket. But you didn't see many of them because they were town troops and they were little garrisons, and they certainly didn't come up into the hills. I mean, if anyone was going to make a drive, and that didn't happen too often because it was suicide to come up into those mountains. I mean, you imagine that the veins, if you like, of the country, the arteries that leading from village to village were mule tracks, and probably a mule track of one mule wide, going round boulders and up and down dale. Now you could have a sniper 500 yards away; he could hold up an entire army if they can only go round there one at a time, and he keeps hitting the man that comes round. Now, the Germans came up occasionally, and they did it in style because they didn't just come from one direction. And they used their airplane, their aircraft. The Italians you never saw. Those that came up to us, as I say, they were full of gratitude. They sort of fell on their hands and knees and grovelled. I think mainly out of relief at having made it so far, you know, frightened of the dark and what they might meet round the corner. I'm afraid They were very low in my estimation. They were just figures of fun in uniforms.
When you first got to Greece, did you know that ALAS was a communist organised force?
Not before I went in. But then I knew very little about them when I was going in. All I knew is we were going into an area to form up or get going a band that had just started. It was assumed that Saros was going to form his band. It was known that he was making his way up there with men, and when we went in, he had his couple of hundred men. But apart from that, I knew very, very, very little. I was going in as a radio operator, and I knew very little of the country, nothing of the language or the people, and I was just going in. I had done my course on coding, which I wasn't looking forward to because that was a time-consuming job, and I knew I was a good operator and that there'd be no trouble in that respect. And that basically was all I was going to do. I never knew when we first started that I would go down and help blow railways and things. It became a bit of fun after a while, but didn't do much of it. But basically, my knowledge of what it was all about was pretty minimal.
Whilst you were there, what did the attitude amongst the population generally seem to be towards the question of the king returning?
To the average Greek, it didn't mean very much. To the average Greek, it didn't mean very much that, you know, Athens was down there and the people that rule our country live in that town down there. For generations, they had looked after their sheep, their women had spun their wool, and in the main, the average inhabitant of this little village couldn't tell you the name of the village 20 miles away. He knew every village around him, radiating in all directions for that distance. But they had their own little area, their own little plots in the hills. They made their own wine. And we didn't mix very much with the townsfolk. We had charming, cultured, well-educated people that came up to us. I mean, our interpreter eventually was one of the housemasters at Athens College, had played bridge for Greece, Panayoti Mariettis. Was a wonderful man, and some of the officers with Psaros' band were journeyed, charming, cultured people that you would, you know, look up to and respect in any culture or any country. But 95% of them weren't in our particular band. 95% of the country were just illiterate shepherds. You ask them if they'd ever been to school, they wouldn't know what you're talking about because they wouldn't know what a school was. All they knew, all they'd learned, had been passed down through the family over the period of generations, centuries, and was centred on their little town, their little area.
So you didn't come across arguments or discussions about republicanism or royalism?
No. They were bombarded by EAM eventually from all sides, absolutely saturated with propaganda, because ELAS was forming up into the main party, the troops in the field, not EAM, ELAS. EAM was the political side of it, and they were mainly in Athens. They had a hardcore up in the hills of officers or politicians, but the rank and file would just be gathered together in the little village square, or most villages were too small to have a square, just a dozen houses on the side of the mountain, and that's where those people lived that had that little area. They would one day be visited by a wandering band of Elas who had heard that there was a village there, and they'd go down there and they would cajole, they would plead, they would threaten, they'd coerce. And the next thing you knew, that there was an indoctrinated village who thought communism was the be-all and end-all of their very existence, and half the men had been, well, had joined, either due to coercion and threatening, or had fallen for this hook, line and sinker. You're told that, and when you get a semi-literate man who is told that you are a shepherd, join us, and that fellow over the hill who isn't a shepherd, and has 1,000 sheep, when the war is over, communism is share and share alike, so you can have half of his sheep. Or when the war is over, having helped Mother Russia, they're communists, they will send over planes and you won't have to plough your fields anymore because they will spray your fields with corn. This was the common one.
Was that a story which was actually going round?
Those two. Half of what you see you can have because you are a communist. And they will do your fields for you. They'll come over and they'll spray your fields with corn. And a lot of them believed it.
Were you present when these ALS bands went in and indoctrinated villages?
Oh, I accompanied them on several occasions. We were with one particular party, Nikiforis, Kapitanos Nikiforis, and that was the name of an old general, I think, in the Greco-Turco Wars of 1810 or something. And they use all these pseudonyms, never use their own name. And Nikiforis was the one that was in charge of this band when I was with Ken Ellis. And we would wander around our area with him. And they would go in, and when you first came to a village, especially one of the larger ones, you'd gather all the, or they would gather all the locals, and we'd be there, probably sitting on our mule or leaning against it because we were tired, or we might even be setting up in the local caliva, the local house. And there would be this tirade of words and shouting and screaming and pleading and coercing going on outside. And you'd stick your head around the corner, and the old local politician would still be shouting and giving them the word about how good communism was, and it certainly swelled their ranks. If someone put in a bad word against Mr. X, Mr. X would be invited to go along with them and become a soldier. If Mr. X was a young lad that thought the thing to do was to take up arms, he'd go along with them. If Mr. X was in any way sort of related to anyone that was already in the band, he would be expected to go along with uncle or brother and this and that. And when you left the village, you would go along with half as many again from those that would, through some way or means, had decided to join the local band. Especially towards the end, they were getting stronger and stronger and stronger.
Do you think there was any genuine pro-German feeling amongst any section of the Greek population you came
across? All of them. And they loathed and detested everything to do with the German army because every village had lost somebody or other. Because when the Italians came in and tried to take Greece by force and failed dismally, a lot of Greeks went down there and were fighting on the northern front and were finding it quite easy to do. Then, of course, the Germans came in with them. And the Germans and the Italians between them proceeded to push out the British troops and the New Zealanders and the Anzacs. And many, many people made for the hills. I mean, when we went in over a period of time, we probably gathered 50 British, Australian, New Zealand soldiers that had been left, and a couple of Cypriots that had been left behind and took to the mountains rather than be taken POW. I can think of many of them. Charlie Much, the New Zealander Lance Corporal, or Corporal on the Assapos Bridge was a New Zealander that was left behind and went up to the mountains. Lou Northover, Ronnie Strake, names that immediately come to mind. They went up into the hills, and a lot of Greeks did the same, an awful lot of Greeks. And once they started spreading their story, and it wasn't propaganda, this was fact, they had been fighting the Germans and the Italians, and they'd come up there. A lot of the Greeks up in the mountains joined the various bands initially, because of this. The initial composition of all the bands were those that wanted to get back at the people that had taken their country.
As a British serviceman in Greece, would you get a universal welcome everywhere you went, or not?
Yes. They would go out of their way to help. I think that we were some peculiar phenomenon to them, because most of them had never seen a man from Athens, never mind a foreigner. And you go wandering in your uniform. Mind you, your uniform after a while began to get a bit bedraggled, although they did supply us whenever we needed anything. You were occasionally wearing good stuff, occasionally wearing bad. If ever we had to go down into the town, it was a little bit dicey. We would wear the rotten stuff, because our cover story was that we were left behind in the evacuation, which the German would respect you for, going up into the hill rather than become a prisoner. They may knock you around in the process, but at least you were alive. And your good uniforms you would keep to keep warm up in the mountain. And you walked into a village that had never seen a Brit before, and they'd flock round you and have an ouzo and have a bit of sandwich. And never, ever, when we were anywhere near a village, do we have to live out in the open under the skies, because they would come and drag you in and give you a bed. The wife's dowry, which, you know, they were still keeping for the daughter, and you could use their blankets. And if they hadn't got anything like that, I mean, they'd give you the last thing they had. They would clear their mules out in the little stable next door, put down fresh straw. At least you're on the cover, because those mountains are hard and cold. If you are out in the open, it could be a little bit hard. But if you were anywhere near a village, they made you welcome. They gave you whatever they had, even if it meant denuding their shells or even going without themselves. But really, they really went out of their way.
You talked about your cover story regarding the Germans, but if they broke your cover story and could show that you were an agent who was dropped in, what did you expect would happen to you?
Well, hopefully, being in uniform, that you would become a POW. I mean, when MacLeish and Bill the Frenchman were taken prisoner up at Narida on the airstrip, just outside Anfazor on our DZ, we had a dropping zone there, which we used and proved our undoing. I mean, having used it regularly for a month or so, they made a push, and they came up there, and in the hut that we were using, they just battered down the door, and there was Bill the Frenchman and Jock MacLeish, Ginger MacLeish, and they just took them both prisoner and had letters from both of them in a POW cage in Germany. Which was why, where possible, you always wore uniform. You didn't wear uniform if you went down into a big town, of course. You just drew attention to yourself.
Can we say something about Brigadier Myers, as he is
Eddie.
Now? And how you came into contact with him?
Eddie, I believe, was the oldest active paratroop during the war. He was 45 years old when he jumped into Greece. I got on right with Eddie because my father had been in the engineers, Captain QM. And the first time I met him, I mentioned this, and it was always code names or surnames. And with Geoffrey Gordon Creed, it was Jeff or Bill. If anyone else was around, if any other senior man was around, I would always Sir Jeff. But when he wanted me, it was always Bill.